Next case is 95-2059, Kenneth Rupp and Debbie Rupp versus D. Thomas Hague, DBA Hague Printing. Mr. Shriver.
I'd like to reserve additional time on the rebuttal. My name is Steve Shriver, representing the Appellant Bauer Company in the appeal. Before addressing the specific proposition of law raised in this appeal, I'd like to suggest case is considerably more complicated, the jury is considerably more confused, and the court of appeals indicated. The case involves consumer claims, cross claims, counter claims, sounding in contract, sounding in tort, and in professional negligence. The facts are set forth in considerable detail in the brief. With the end result, the accident of the business deal collapsed, and the party went to court, the appellant. The broker in the transaction got a lot. Buyer and to Mr. Hague, seller, even though the appellant was effectively out of the loop during the critical times when the parties and the technical advisor, the lawyers, and in the case of Rump, their accountant, were negotiating the sale of Mr. Hague's printing company.
Would it be oversimplification to assume that the jury found against your client, against Bauer, because they believed that? The jury believed that Bauer had not given the purchasers information about the drop in sales, this dramatic decline in sales. Does that seem to be one rationale upon which the jury could have found that the seller should recover from your client?
Seller from the public?
Yes.
That was part of it, except for the fact.
And the buyer, but I'm curious about the seller's recovery from also.
I think that is quite curious, Your Honor. The parties dealt with each other. Claimed that Mr. Rupp spent a considerable amount of time during the months between the time the broker and Helen put him in contact with the seller. That business engaged an attorney, engaged an accountant to represent his interests. The information was there. The seller was in just as good a position, if not better, and undoubtedly better position to disclose that information. Moreover, the accountant failed to look at the 1991 financial data from the company, and that clearly shown, the plaintiff's expert testified that the business was in trouble.
I'm happy you started your argument out the way you did, because I really struggled with this case when I was reading the briefs. I was trying to figure out what proposition of law that we really haven't discussed before that you would want us to discuss, and I'm going to give it to you as pointedly as I can, because I want you to know what I'm thinking so you get a fair shot at me, figuratively. It seems to me this is purely factual, and those matters were determined by a jury, and therefore we should be bound by that. Let's go to the next step. I recognize your argument about the fact that are these joint wrongdoers and should one indemnify the other. We've written on that a number of times. I recognize your point that the general verdict was inconsistent maybe with one of the interrogatories or what happened. We've written on that a number of times. What is there in this case that is not factual that we should determine?
What is in the case that is not factual is the distinction between a case of fraud, paragraphs of mere fraud, or constructive fraud, and a case of egregious fraud, which is evidenced by malice, ill will, gross, want, all those adjectives have been used. What we are arguing here
facts. Clear and convincing evidence is going to be facts. So haven't we also written on the fraud issue and the malice issue and Preston versus Murdy and a whole other line of cases?
That is correct. I would submit to the court that this case is most analogous to the Miles case, in which this court overturned a judgment of damages that was entered against the banks when the banks were involved in a transaction, a real estate transaction, failed to disclose to the buyers that the property they were purchasing and the property that the bank was making a loan on was suffering from termite damage and cost the buyer a lot of money to fix it. The bank was held liable for the compensatory damages associated with fixing the termite problem. But this court overturned the judgment of punitive damages that was assessed against the bank because they found no egregious conduct in that case. I might also point out that the cases in which punitive damages have been upheld have typically, in fact in every case, have involved the principal of the transaction, either a seller who was misrepresenting, or the real party in interest, an insurance company who was misrepresented or acted maliciously.
Okay, I understand that, and I understand the termite case. Again, aren't those all factual differences? You want us to find that there was no evidence that was egregious enough to have an assessment by the court and the jury of punitive damages here. And isn't that based on whatever facts are produced at a particular trial?
That and the legal weight that the court below put on a, in effect, imposing fiduciary relationship on the broker in this case, largely because it had prior contact with this particular buyer in another transaction. This is in the Court of Appeals opinion. Again, that also goes to egregiousness because a fiduciary could obviously have a higher standard than would a non-fiduciary.
Okay, for purposes of argument, let's accept that, that we even find that. What principle of law comes out of that? Don't we just say that if the, I mean, aren't you asking us to say if the finding of fact is not egregious enough, therefore no punitive damages? How is that any principle that guides 11 million people in Ohio?
It does. Again, I think the principle can be gleaned here when you state that when the party to whom, against whom rather, the punitive damages, attorney's fee award is to be assessed, has a limited role in the transaction, then that standard of egregiousness is higher than when the party is the principal in the transaction or when that party is a fiduciary in the transaction. Again, in this case, the true fiduciary, the attorney, the accountant, let their client down. Those are the people who had fiduciary responsibility, not the seller's broker, not the seller's agent.
That goes to the reliance element of fraud. That's the point of that argument, that one of the elements of fraud is reliance, justifiable reliance. And we're saying that in as much as the Browns had their own fiduciaries to advise them, then the jury could not have found reliance, could not have found
fraud. No, I'm saying this level is egregious.
I know, but you don't have a proposition of law.
I'm not arguing the basic fraud count.
Okay, I know, it's not egregious. You're saying it's not egregious because
when you make the transaction as a whole, it's not egregious.
Made that lawyer and an accountant.
Exactly.
And yet, isn't the real factual point, and Justice Douglas makes the point, is factual. Couldn't the jury have found here that one single factor, and that is if your client Bauer acted all alone, did not convey that, you know, one point of information that was given to her, that the business was down 50% and that the new buyer would need to bring to the table some portion, some business of their own? That it doesn't even require principal agent, it's expected to be active fraud on the part of Bauer.
But that non-disclosure, we're arguing, was mere fraud, constructive fraud, and not egregious fraud, but fraud motivated by malice or ill will that gives
guess I was trying to make to you without being too persistent on it is that we've written on all of these points. For instance, in your proposition of law number one, as recently as 1989, we wrote on that issue. And proposition of law number two, as recently as 1995. And proposition of law number three, 1993. Now, let me assume, for just purposes of argument, that there was clear error here. This court can't become a court of error. It has to be a court of law. And I need to search. If I'm assigned to write this case, I have to know what you want me to say that is not factual, that establishes a proposition of law to guide the bench and the bar of this state. When you said it on each of your three propositions, and I guess my last question, and I'll let you alone, I promise you, haven't you waived all that? You never raised those in the lower court. First two, anyway.
First two, I'm
sorry. The issues that you're now requiring, the inconsistent instructions, the jury not following the instructions of the judge.
I don't believe a waiver occurred. There was a motion for notwithstanding the verdict by the appellant's former counsel immediately after the verdict was announced. And the verdict was clearly consistent between the trial court's instructions vis-a-vis Mr. Hague and the verdict that came in. And as the judge said, he can't find for Hague on the cross claim. If he acted improperly, he was found liable for fraud, liable for breach of covenant of good faith and fair dealing. Clearly improper conduct, clearly didn't support the faith.
Okay, let's assume all that's true. Did counsel call that to the attention of the judge before the jury was discharged?
Not before the jury was discharged, immediately thereafter. That was former counsel.
But our rule is that you've got to give the judge a chance to correct it if there's an error.
The obvious error there, and as we argue, even though so far as being plain error, was that the jury did not follow the judge's instructions in that instance. Highly prejudicial, highly contrary to long-standing precedents of this court regarding the relationship between the current court feasors, the right to seek indemnification or contribution between the current court feasors.
Ms. Ferguson.
May it please the court, counsel. Good morning. The appellant's arguments as to my client, the appellee defendant, D. Thomas Hay, relate to inconsistency, both between the verdict in favor of the Bronx against Hay and in favor of Hay against the Bauer Company. Also, the apparent between the interrogatories and the general verdict. As Justice Douglas has mentioned, the court appealed the trial court's decision on procedural grounds, holding that the rationale of O'Connell versus Jeffrey and Heinlein versus Henry applies here, that the issue of the inconsistency must be raised before the jury is dismissed, so to allow the trial court the opportunity to remand the case to the jury for further deliberations if necessary. In fact, the Court of Appeals specifically held that appellant's trial counsel had ample opportunity to object to the inconsistency. A recess was taken after the verdicts were read, and that was the opportunity for appellant's counsel to find this inconsistency, and she did not. Appellant's counsel also argued that this case was very long and complex, and it may have been as long for the jury, but the complexity does not mean that appellant's counsel could not find the allegedly plain and blatant inconsistency between the general verdict or between the general verdict and the interrogatory. To circumvent this procedural argument, which is our position that should be, the Court of Appeals opinion should be upheld basically on procedural grounds, wide umbrella of the plain error doctrine, which the Court of Appeals considered sui sponte and refused to apply, denying the appellant the reversal of the trial court's decision.
Can I stop you there for just a moment, please? Because that was curious, and I wondered why you didn't argue it, and I guess I can't remember where we've adopted, what is it, about Rule 52, the criminal rules 52B, I think, is plain error. The civil rule is Rule 61, and it's only harmless error. Where do we get the plain error doctrine in civil cases?
As cited in the appellant's brief, there are several cases in which this court has applied the plain error doctrine in civil cases, although the court has emphasized it's a very rare and exceptional procedure, and it's so used.
There isn't even a rule for it.
Pardon me?
There isn't even a rule for it.
That's correct. I believe the court invoked it in O'Connell versus Chesapeake, and that case can be readily distinguished from this one. In that case, the jury returned interrogatories answering questions based upon the negligence of the defendant in that case, and also returned interrogatories answering the question of the contributory negligence, and it was later found upon review that the same jurors that had signed the interrogatories returning the verdict of negligence had not signed the same, and were not the same jurors that signed the interrogatories apportioning that negligence. And so in that respect, it would have required a more careful review of the interrogatory forms to find that error. But in this case, I don't believe that's the case. I think that if there was an apparent inconsistency, it would have been obvious from the face of the response to the interrogatories. So if we get to the plain error doctrine, the question really becomes, did the jury fail to follow the trial court's instructions, or is there an inconsistency? And I will attempt to reconcile this inconsistency so that the Court of Appeals opinion can be upheld. And looking at this case from, and I mentioned some part of this argument in my brief, but I'd like to elaborate upon it in oral argument, the theory that any fraud that Fowler committed was attributed to Hayes. And I think if you take a very close look at the jury instructions on the cross-claim, it states, if you find against Hayes because of improper actions taken by Fowler as Hayes' agent, was there a finding against Hayes? Yes, there was. The jury returned an interrogatory answering the question of whether Mr. Hayes had withheld material information from the ROMs when there was a duty to disclose it. But why was there a finding against Hayes? Was it because of improper actions taken by Bauer as Hayes' agent? Yes. Was it because of improper actions taken by Hayes himself? No. To lend further support for this, I think it's important to note that the award against Mr. Hayes and in favor of the ROMs was on their claim for the breach of good faith and fair dealing. There were no damages awarded on the fraud claim. This lends further support to the theory that the jury focused very closely on this instruction, and they determined each question presented to it under all the instructions they were given, which is exactly what the juries are supposed to do. They looked at that instruction and said, we're supposed to find and again pay because of what Bauer did.
That seems to assume that I read your brief on that point. It seems to assume that the jury believed that that Haig gave Bauer all of the information Bauer needed to give the buyers all the information they needed to know what they were purchasing, and that Bauer didn't give the purchasers all the information or misled them, and that Haig didn't mislead anyone. That's essentially what the jury had to found, wasn't it, to adopt your view of their verdict.
That's correct, Your Honor. And I believe that the facts in the record bear that out. I mean, believe the facts are that Hayes did indeed tell Ms. Bauer this information, and she admits that he told her this information. And he also testified that he had an expectation that she was going to follow his instructions, which were to reveal the information to the ROMs. So it's entirely conceivable that he didn't reveal this information because he believed that she had done so and that she had upheld her duty as his agent.
Had Hayes given Bauer the information about the number of employees the actors were employees that the printing company had.
I believe that he did give her some information, but I'm not entirely certain on exactly what that information was. I don't know whether they actually had a conversation about it or whether the information that he gave her was in writing. I'm not certain about that. So if the jury found against Hay because of Bauer's improper actions, then it's entirely reconcilable that the jury did not find that Hay himself acted improperly, thereby justifying an award on the cross-claim without the finding that Hay did anything wrong. Now, the context of that jury instruction, I construe the word as improperly as meaning fraud. So if Bauer was found guilty of fraud himself or herself, and Hay was found guilty of fraud, not because he himself had acted improperly, but because Bauer had, and the jury was instructed under the law of agency that a principal is bound by an agent acting within the scope of her authority. Bauer admits that she acted within the scope of her authority, and Ohio law then says that the principal is liable for the agent's actions. A principal is held liable for the fraudulent actions of his agent, even if the principal is wholly ignorant of the fraud when the fraud occurs within the scope of the agency. This is not a case where it was an independent, self-serving act by Bauer, an act of venture and spleen, which in no way facilitated or promoted Hay's business. And she did this with the sole purpose of attempting to sell his business. So Hay's liability stems from Bauer's. And the facts bear this out. Hay told Bauer the true facts, and she distorted them. There were things that she left out, she neglected to tell the buyers. And Bauer has not appealed the jury's verdict of fraud against her, and she's paid the compensatory damages to Rom. So there's no appealable issue as to whether she did, in fact, did commit fraud. The jury obviously believed that she was the one engaging in fraud and not Hay. Although it was not addressed in the court below because it was not raised by the appellant there, appellant then argues that the verdict is again inconsistent, this time with the law of indemnification and contribution. And, of course, I submit that this argument was waived by the failure of the Court of Appeals to have an opportunity to rule on it. But even if this court does get to it, in order to recover contribution, he must have joint tort fees. And the rule cited by the appellant regarding indemnification is that between joint tort users chargeable with concurrent negligence, there may be no indemnification or contribution. That's from the global indemnity case. But Bauer and Hay are not joint tort users, because each joint tort user is individually liable for the entire damage, and because joint tort users are in peri delecto as to each other. Was each joint tort user individually liable for the entire damage? That's not the case here. And was the action of the appellant and the appellee Hay of the same character? No. She was held to have committed a fraud that was malicious. And I submit to you that you can't just call them joint tort users if they're not joint tort users. The Supreme Court has previously stated that joint liability can only exist where there is concert of action in pursuit of a common intent. And there's no evidence of that whatsoever in this case. So looking further to the law of indemnification, intent becomes irrelevant, and we come to the fact that Hay was held liable here because of vicarious liability, that he was responsible for Bauer's fraud. He was held liable by interference of law and not by reason of an act of participation in any act. It is also not the case that judgment can only be entered against the agent in cases such as these. In Fox v. Valleybrook, the appellants who were sellers of a home argued that since the trial court found they were liable only because of the acts of their agent, the judgment could only be entered against their agent. And the court simply found that this assignment of error was not well taken. As I stated before, the plain error doctrine is rarely invoked in civil cases, and I think there's no real reason for it to be invoked here. Other cases cited by the appellant dealing with plain error in civil cases, address cases which apportion fault among non-parties, where there are erroneous jury instructions. This is simply not a case where there is a manifest miscarriage of justice. The facts simply don't bear out the application of the plain error doctrine. D. Thomas Hay. If there are some questions from the justices, I would ask that the Court of Appeals' opinion be affirmed.
Thank you, Ms. Ferguson. Mr. Shriver, you've saved about a minute and a half of your time.
First of all, in response to counsel's argument, Mr. Hay ratified every piece of misinformation or every non-disclosure from the ballot. He met repeatedly with Mr. Romp. He never told him the business was going down the drain. Long after the ballot company submitted the inaccurate financial information, which, by the way, Mr. Hay had reviewed and approved. So that adds to that. The court below, the trial court did find Hay liable for the breach of covenant of good faith and fair dealing. This is clearly improper conduct, no vicarious liability there. Even if the fraud claim somehow would be characterized as vicarious liability with respect to Mr. Hay. This is one transaction. The appellant seems to suggest here, the appellee seems to suggest here that the two wrongs make a right. Somehow they're entitled to be compensated because they wrongly treated the wrongs concurrently as opposed to in the same transaction as the account here. And that's inaccurate as well. This one transaction, Mr. Hayes conducts himself improperly, withheld information, is in a much better position to disclose that information. Furthermore, he withheld information the appellant as well as from the buyer, and to suggest that Hayes had no primary liability here is contrary to the record and cannot be harmonized. Thank you.
The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.